I wanted to thank you guys for last week, last Wednesday, with the sharing. I don't know how long it went for. It could have continued for the whole session as far as I'm concerned. We're looking fine, I believe, on time. In fact, Lord willing, we will finish up chapter 2 next week. And that will also include more interaction next week. So let me give this as a preface. We're going to be covering next week verses 23 through 28. Dealing on Sabbath controversy. It's one of the more controversial things even inside of Christendom today. And so here's my deal to you. Share whatever at the end. But we're going to walk through this. So just kind of go into this week saying at least, I'm not saying don't take anything from early parts of chapter 2. Share that. Share freely. But just, we're only going to actually cover 6 verses next week in here. And then I want to open it up to having somebody read again. And then interaction on that deal. And in fact, today I got a call around 4 o'clock today. No, it wasn't a call. It was a text from an aunt. And she's a believer, her and her husband. And a while back I had, at the first of the year, shot my grandmother and some different people some things. As Savannah and Jake were talking about some of the different posts, at different sermons, different things they were going to. And anyway, so my aunt shoots me a text today. And says, hey, I've listened to your first 2 messages on Mark, and said some very positive things. And then there was a comment I'd made about the Sabbath. And there was a text, man, wanting me to maybe look at some passages in light of something. So I shot her back and said, hey, you know, next week I'm looking to cover that a little more fully, a little more in detail. And I shot her back something to maybe look in preparation. So I want to encourage you to perhaps have that as the topic this next week. I don't mean you got to get on there and break out your commentaries or spend an exhaustive amount of time looking over this. Do whatever, but I just want to share with you the topic of next week. It's also very blessed Sunday morning, obviously, with the message, and I'm looking forward to Sunday again with that the message and the fervent prayer of Elijah. And I was very blessed for Deborah to get up and share, and that's moving according to walking in the Holy Spirit to me. I've had that experientially happen when the Spirit of God's not going to give you a peace about something. And you're saying, well, maybe if this happens or that happens or it won't. And then sure enough, those 2 individuals broach her and come to her. And I was so blessed by her sharing that. You know what it reminded me of? And James, you'd be familiar with this. You and Josh brought this up months ago before we even started anything on apologetics from Fred Phelps. Fred Phelps, out there from Westboro Baptist Church. Now, Westboro Baptist Church, I want you to grab something here, is a cult. And it has Baptists in the title. Okay? I think a lot of times we just merely by default say, well, the cults, those are those JWs. By the way, I don't know, some of us may be wanting to go sit down at the Kingdom Hall here before too long as part of our class. I don't know. But they're a cult. And he pronounces the same language that Deborah was sharing in here about hate of a particular people. Another thing that they really like to do is they like to go to military funerals and applaud and act like that's the Spirit of Christ. It makes me want to puke. James White and them used to have a ministry, and predominantly what they would do, they would go to Utah, down to the Mormon temple, and hand out tracts and witness out there. They don't do that anymore. Maybe that's something we can pray about for a future mission trip. No, I'm kidding. One of the reasons they don't do that anymore, it wasn't that the Mormons were absolutely standoffish to them. It was Phelps and his little following that absolutely ruined it. Because as they continued to go down there with their mantras of hate, the Mormons would stiff-arm anybody who had a Christian voice. Didn't want to hear any of it. So thank you for sharing that. I'm going to give you a quick heads up. We're not going to start out tonight in Luke 14. I don't sigh too deep. One of the reasons is I had a phone call from a guy today, not from here, but a friend today calling asking me a question. And I actually referenced him to Luke 14. And I've done that several times in here, but we're not going to go to Luke 14. I've already been in Luke 14 today with him. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's one of the reasons I want to do this. From Mark last week, Chapter 2, verse 5. Had great feedback even afterwards. Had people coming up, man, interjecting stuff, sharing stuff, posing questions. One of them was this from verse 5. When Jesus saw their faith, He said to the paralytic, "Son, your sins are forgiven." So He goes right to the sins. I want to do this briefly. You don't have to turn there. I would like it if you would. This is going to be the majority of our turning. It's going to be right here at the start before we continue in Mark 2. If you want to follow me through something briefly, it's going to be about 5 minutes, but I need to address this. I was going to address it last week and I didn't, but I'm going to go ahead and address it today. Flip with me to Isaiah chapter 1 if you would. This may be a little deep. I'm not going to try to go too deep with this concept. But I tell you what, guys, we're all at different places and all at different levels. So we got some brand new converts and we have some seasoned people. I just want to throw this out there. And it's going to be dealing with the question that was posed to me with regards to, are you saying that Jesus didn't have a concern about physical healing? With a comment that was made later at the tail end of chapter 1. And we're going to deal with this concept. Isaiah chapter 1, I'm going to start in verse 2. "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. Children have I reared and brought up, but they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, and the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly. They have forsaken the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They are utterly estranged. Why will you still be struck down? Why will you continue to rebel? The whole head is sick and the whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but bruises and sores and raw wounds. They are not pressed out or bound up or softened with oil." Now, go ahead and flip to Isaiah 53. I'm not going to give a huge amount of context, but this is one of the most often used messianic texts, and it's beautiful. I'm not underscoring that at all. But here's what I want to lay out. The reason I started right there in Isaiah 1, where it was talking about he's sick from the top of his head to the soles of his feet, in other words, is it's talking about a spiritual sickness. And it's using that concept of a physical infirmity. So in Isaiah 53:5, "But he," that being Jesus, "was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed." And a lot of people say, physical healing. This is where I said I'm going to go a little deep, but then we're going to move on to Matthew chapter 8. You can turn over there if you want to make your way over there. A lot of people say, physical healing based on Isaiah 53:5 was purchased in the atonement, just like the forgiveness of sins was. And I'm not talking about just bad teaching. I'm talking about reputable people like an Andrew Murray have held this. But I want us to look at something. Flip over to Matthew chapter 8, please. And then if you want to go ahead and make a finger in 1 Peter chapter 2, you can. I'm going to start in 16. Matthew 8, verse 16. "That evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick." Verse 17. "This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases." So Messiah is actually accomplishing this. He's fulfilling this right here in the first century. And look at what an inspired apostle, though, would say about this very same passage, this very same concept. If you've already made your way to 1 Peter, you're ahead of me. Let me get there. 1 Peter chapter 2. Let's do verses 24 and 25. "He himself," that being Jesus, "bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed." Okay, you tracking with me? You following with me? Look what he says in 25. "For you were straying like sheep, but now have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls." That's the fulfillment of the healing by the inspired apostle Peter with reference to the people in Isaiah's day about needing healing and, more importantly, all those prophetic passages. Now, I'm not saying the Lord today doesn't heal. I'm not saying that in the least bit. What I'm saying is you can't make the argumentation, and we're not going to continue to go here, on my theology, that physical healing is demanded in the atonement because of the justice of God the Father having to do that to the Son. They don't equate. Okay, there was a little bit of confusion. I know that's a little technical, but I had the questions on that. If y'all want to revisit that next week, we can. Let's go ahead and get into the Gospel of Mark. I'm going to go ahead and read it like we've been accustomed to. Verse 13. He went out again beside the sea, and all the crowd was coming to him, and he was teaching them. And as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth, and said to him, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. And as he reclined at table in his house, many tax collectors and sinners were reclining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. And the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." Now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. And people came and said to him, "Why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" And Jesus said to them, "Can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day. No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is destroyed, and so are the skins. But new wine is for fresh wineskins." When we get into that latter portion, 18 through 22, I am going to ask actually for some input from you guys on the last two verses. And then that'll probably be something else that we may pick up with last week. So just to give you a heads up. Now, I don't want you to be preoccupied. Probably shouldn't have said that, but I won't call on you. I won't call on you. It's going to be volunteer-based. Verse 13. It's fascinating. He was teaching them. He was teaching them. Man, again, we've seen that in Mark, man. He's preaching, he's teaching. In the natural, he's tired, and yet, man, he's always moved with anguish and pity and just moved with compassion. And how can that just sticks out to me. He was teaching them. Verse 14, it says Levi. Now that Levi there, guys, that's Matthew. Okay? That's Matthew, who authored the first gospel. I don't mean the first one written, but I mean the first one in our New Testament. Okay? And actually, in the parallel account, you can see that over in Matthew's rendering. Levi is a little suspect in Mark on some of the way the stuff is in the original language, but it's clear over in Luke 5. Levi is Matthew. And by the way, Eric raised a great question last week. And a little bit of contrast here, Eric. Most people believe that he had the four. You know, he had the brothers, Andrew, Peter, James, and John. Probably didn't leave immediately. We went back and forth a little bit about that. Some even speculate, I didn't say this to you, some even think that they had met him, he went out to the baptism, and after the 40 days came back and then maybe followed him. But here, a lot of people say this is immediate, especially in the usage of the language here. It's forceful. Jesus comes in and says this, and some speculate, man, you know, being a tax collector wasn't a real popular profession. You know, you were really despised by your own people. Because the way that you made money was you got a percentage of tax for the Romans. But you upped that because whatever you went above what the Romans were requiring of you was your profit. And so they weren't real popular guys, needless to say. And yet Jesus, in verse 14 there, passed by, saw Levi sitting at the booth, said to him, "Follow me." He rose and followed him. Verse 15. As he reclined at table in his house, many tax collectors and sinners were reclining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. That verbiage right there is usually used in Mark for the concept of right there being many that followed him. Whose house are they in? Whose house are they in? More than it's almost certain because of Luke, again, Luke chapter 5, verse 29, if you wanted a reference. If you're writing references down, if you're going to go back and look at some of these, Luke 5:29 says it's Levi's house. So Levi's got up and he's followed him, and they're going in and they're going to have this feast here in Levi's house. But he's got some company. You know, he's got some friends. And that's verse 16. But then you got the scribes and the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" Always the heart of a religious person. Flip with me real quick. I didn't know if I was going to do this. Flip with me, please, to Matthew 11. Just kind of give you a little... This isn't the parallel account per se to this, but let me just give you a little bit of a flavor about individuals. I'm going to start in verse 16. Matthew chapter 11, verse 16. "But to what shall I compare this generation? It's like children sitting in the marketplace and playing and calling to their playmates. 'We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We sang a dirge, and you did not mourn.'" In those days, there were professional mourners. Kind of think of Miss Ruby out there at Trail of Life doing that. There were actually people that you had hired, you know, in case at your funeral nobody really would weep or mourn over you. You had people hired that would come in and mourn your death. And verse 17 said, "We played the flute for you," and I just read that. Verse 18, "For John came," he's referring to John the Baptizer here, "neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon." Verse 19, "The Son of Man," that being Jesus, "came eating and drinking, and they say, 'Look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.' Yet wisdom is justified by her deeds." Religious people, it doesn't matter how you are coming and approaching and ministering to them, they absolutely want no part of true God-inspired spirit living. They're always critical. I was going to save this to the very tail end, but I think I'm going to go ahead and say it now. And I'm not talking about anybody in this sanctuary. And if my wife were in here, I'd probably be a little bothered that I even said this. But throughout the week, she was challenged, and somebody challenging her on something. And let me just say this, be careful of having kind of a reputation. It reminds me of a pastor once said, he said, the reputation of the certain lady in the church, periodically what he would do is he'd say, "Sister so-and-so, would you go ahead and stand us up and lead us in a word of criticism?" I mean, that was just who she was. I tell you what, I appreciate you guys who sit there and love and come alongside our wives and different people who can't be in here tonight periodically. I love your spirit about that. I'm going to flip back to Mark. I'm going to say a few things here that are going to be a little off topic. Just going to forewarn you. And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." I started in here tonight talking about a debate going on Calvinism tomorrow night between Mike Brown and James White. I'm sure that you've gotten this hermeneutic from Joshua Torrey. But as I go through this gospel, one of the things that I want to do to you guys is because I've been, so to speak, on both sides of this particular debate. And instead of me branching off, because, you know, that'd be the entire 2013, and I don't know how far we'd get into all 5 points. But what I'll do periodically is I'll say, tough passage for the non-Calvinist. Tough passage for the Calvinist. And the reason I'm doing that, I have a friend up north who's actually looking right now to perhaps write a small book. And he's a Calvinist. And what he wants to do, though, is he wants to cut to the nitty-gritty and quit acting like there's not difficulties on both sides of this particular doctrine. And he's maybe wanting to get my take on some difficult passages from my perspective. I mean, because there definitely are some. Be a little leery of individuals on certain doctrines who act like, there's not any ambiguity whatsoever. What's wrong with you? Be a little leery of that. Now, I have a pull... to where, I'll just throw this out there. I would really openly embrace Doug Wilson's complete systematic theology, I think. I'm drawn to it. Philosophically, here's part of the difficulty. When I was going through this particular doctrine, and there's others, I got tired of playing exegetical hopscotch. And you say, what do you mean by that? Well, you got one foot on this verse right here, and then there's two others that completely look like they do something different, and vice versa. You got two over on this side, and then one. And it's tiring no matter what end you're on, no matter what side you're on. So one of the things that I appreciated about Josh in his most recent, or at least the most recent one I listened to, was 1997 Ligonier Conference. And he prefaced it with some stuff on the debate on baptism, who the proper recipient is to be of New Covenant baptism. And one of the things that he said in there was personality. Hey, I wish I could go here. I understand that leaning, that pull for us to want to go with maybe the personality that we like more, or the person who sounds more articulate, or whatever the case may be. It is just imperative to always continue to be examined and to examine yourself. How in the world are we going to grow anywhere? And one of the things that I love about the concept of the Sunday school shuffle is it doesn't just allow you to stay under one little individual for this amount of time's teaching, and you've never heard contrary things of the sort. I was like that for about, you know, at least my first 3 years. I thought, how in the world could nobody be a Calvinist? I'm different in this regard. And this is important, I believe. I do not have an emotional objection to the doctrines of grace, so-called. That's not where I'm at. That is for most non-Calvinists that I meet. They're very emotional about the doctrine. That's not my issue. I have others, but that's not it. So anyway, you say, man, why did you share all this? Why did you say all that? Well, one, I don't know if I'd publicly shared that with James and Josh about, man, I would be absolutely content to really follow along. And I'm telling you, there's a pool. 90% of people that I interact with, read, listen to, are all Reformed. There's a strong pull for me to just, man, at night. Now, here's a flip side. One last principle and application for you that I did on a different doctrine. And you'll see this when we go through Mark 13. And don't go here. This is important. No matter how far you are on in your walk, I remember a guy for the first time, he came and he began to walk me through the Olivet Discourse. And I basically saw things the way John MacArthur did. And he began to walk me through it. And I didn't want to hear anything the guy had to say. In fact, I was turned off by it. Now, it wasn't just so much because it was going to completely throw me off from my present deal. I had a little bit of spiritual animosity or envy toward the guy who was presenting it to me. And I really kind of wanted him to be wrong. I don't know if any of you have ever been there, but be guarded against that, because that can arise inside of us. I'm sure none of y'all have ever experienced that, so let my confession stand as, what's wrong with you, brother? Okay, back in Mark 2:18. John's disciples and Pharisees were fasting, and people came and said to him, now, I've already said that in these next, you know, five verses or so, I want to have some interaction from you guys here in the last 3 to 5 minutes on the last two. About a year ago, in fact, it'll be a year ago in March, I had the privilege of preaching here, filling in for James on a Sunday morning. And the sermon text, the passage wasn't from Mark, but it was dealing with this where God got a hold of me, and it was entitled, I love Barry, brother, you mind if me ask, can you possibly give me a title for something like that? You were all over the place, and some things never change. But it was a question, and I get, the title was Hunger for the Bridegroom. Hunger for the Bridegroom. And I love that language. The reason I shared with you that it's on there, I'm not going to go very deep in here on this tonight. I'm not. Like I said, I gave a whole sermon pretty much on about four verses on that Sunday. So if you want to utilize some of the stuff that Barry and the different people that put into things, man, at the website and everything along those lines, and this particular thing is of interest to you, you can go, and there's others that have shared on similar things. But what's fascinating is it says, why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? You ever notice that about individuals who are doing religious things, and yet they're more worried about what others are getting to do and what they're having to do? They're having to do it because for them it's a duty. And by golly, if I have to do this, why in the world aren't your disciples doing it, sir? The Pharisees fasted twice a week. Isn't it interesting? John, in the message that that great humble man started, has disciples who have, in this particular sense, have joined in with the Pharisees, and they're worried about the very same thing. Now, John's imprisoned at this time. I could go on a tangent. I got to be careful in there about what was going on with some of John's movement. Part of the deal is they fell in love, I guess you could say this way, they fell in love with the mailman rather than the message, or the sender, or the carrier. I think Piper years ago shared a very similar thing. I mean, how bizarre is that? I know we don't necessarily have a postman come up in today's day and age with a personal letter. But let's say with tomorrow being V-Day, let's say that your spouse was removed from you for a season and had written you a love letter. And the mailman comes to deliver it to you, and you're more fixated on the mailman than you are about the letter. That's warped. That's what some of these John's disciples were doing. And Jesus said to them, verse 19, "Can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast." Now, fasting and mourning can be in some of these passages used interchangeably. If anybody's taking notes, let me give you a couple references. We're not going to flip here. But I shared this a year ago, and it still resonates with me. The bridegroom is powerful language. Isaiah chapter 61, verse 10. Isaiah chapter 61, verse 10. Isaiah chapter 62, verses 4 and 5. Isaiah 62, verses 4 and 5. Hosea chapter 2, verses 14 through 20. Hosea 2, 14 through 20. There's others, but the reason I give you those is that concept of bridegroom is God Himself. And Jesus is God incarnate, God the Son, and He's saying, while I'm here with you, what in the world is wrong with you while you're wanting people to be sorrowful? They can't fast. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them. I love Josh when he was sharing in here. He pointed out just usage of language about forceful. He did that when he was, the Son was led by the Spirit into the wilderness. This is forceful language right here too. When the bridegroom is taken away from them, it's like right there, that arrest in Gethsemane. He's taken. Same kind of way that John the Baptist is, taken because of Herod, his cowardice. I thank God for individuals who feel led to fast. Some people act like it was only for the 3 days. But I'll give you this couple references too. Acts chapter 13, verses 2 and 3. Acts chapter 13, verses 2 and 3. Acts chapter 14, verse 23 shows the Spirit-filled apostles fasting because their bridegroom has been taken away with decision-making and all these things that are going on. I love that some people are so hungry for God to move in an incredible way that you feel led to fast. But please, please, please don't fall into the trap of thinking that your prayer life or your reading of the Scriptures or your fasting or anything like that, that somehow God owes you or is indebted to you. Or if things all of a sudden get excruciatingly tough in the circumstance, that all I'll have in my back pocket the old fast method or principle. Now, one of the things that's fascinating, though, is you may be so overcome and overwhelmed and so burdened and so broken that you're saying, God, let my fast be like when Paul would say, pray without ceasing. And I said, that doesn't mean not to go to sleep at night, Jerry. But some people believe that fasting is kind of a continual prayer. It's showing that continuation of it. I'm just continuing on with you, Lord. And at times when those hunger pains come, instead of filling my belly and you know how it gets, man, it starts to growl like a spoiled child. It's not starving. All right. I'm going to look to conclude. What I'd like, I said, from interaction. Maybe some of you ladies here in verse 21 who have grown boys, raised some boys. I don't know if any of y'all sewed, but could somebody, one of you sisters, anybody can, but one of you sisters, could you tell me a little, describe to me a little bit about what happened if, Billy Joe playing a little football or whatever, running around or whatever he was doing as a youngster, probably building something, happened to have a little hole in his pants. And one of y'all share with me what would happen if you just continued to do kind of what verse 21 said. any of y'all did any patchwork. Thank you. Thank you, Charlotte. Verse 22, again, anybody can chime in, and that does include Charlotte with this other one. But 22, somebody maybe give me an explanation of what they think's going on there with the concept of the fermentation of wine and what's going on there with the concept of wineskins. You don't have to give me an interpretation of the whole passage, but just kind of what you think is being conveyed. Jesus is using both of these examples to convey a point about His movement, if you will, the kingdom of God. Is wine alive? Is yeast alive? Is yeast living? Are there organisms that are alive during fermentation? Yeah. One guy contrasted water. He said, water's needed for survival, but water's not alive. It's not living. But wine is. And Jesus is the water for us. And then He contrasts the being filled with the Spirit. You know, not getting drunk with the wine, but being filled with the Spirit. And He, we know, is alive in dwelling inside of His people in a particular way. Again, I'd like for somebody to maybe just share. Right here, we got to close. We got to get out of here. Share with me in a nutshell what you think Jesus is conveying with those last two points. Contrasting with the Pharisees and them being uptight about all these sinners. And now, I mean, I could do that. I don't mean to be rude, but that's exact. Yeah, really, really good point. Does anybody have, that's exact, great explanation from Charlotte on the patch. Great explanation from you. If you're to put new wine into that old wineskin during the fermentation, it's not going to hold it. And Jesus, kind of in a nutshell, Scott, go ahead and read that note. Oh, okay. Well, I'll do one. Hadn't quoted him much through this, but this is a good one. This is from MacArthur. The internal gospel of repentance for forgiveness of sin could not be connected to or contained in the old and external tradition of self-righteousness and ritual. We could expand. Some people see some things a little bit differently. We can pick up with that when we conclude next week on the Sabbath. Thank you for this evening. Let me close this in prayer.